Welcome back. So this Ma'amar, she has different titles in the classic literature, but usually it's called Ki Bechol Chochmei HaGoyim Me'ein Kamocha, for amongst all of the wise among the nations, Me'ein Kamocha, there is none like you. There is none like you among all of the wise of the nations, God. That's this Ma'amar. Now, oddly, I'm not sure why exactly. It is related to the one that comes before it and to the teaching that comes after it. And it will eventually become important in the context of the Shavuos wedding night tikkun. So you remember we learned about the Shavuos wedding night tikkun, and that theme, you know, the Zohar layers, it builds layers. And so there aren't clear distinctions. So that this teaching by the mystics is interpreted in context of that night. And they'll make that explicit at the end of the teaching, which we'll either get to at the end of today's class or the beginning of next week's class. And so next week, I'm going to speak a little bit more about the central importance of Shavuot and the Tikkun Leil Shavuot. Because you see in the Zohar, there are really two ways that you learn things. You learn things during the midnight vigil. Let's just call it the midnight vigil. That's what professors call it when they write about this stuff, the midnight vigil. So during the Zohar, they learn things during the midnight vigil, or they learn things while walking on the road. And when they're walking on the road, they either are discussing a verse, so-and-so opened and said, they're walking and discussing, or they meet someone, some animal or person or donkey driver or whatever, that's got a secret coded message for them that you wouldn't expect. Notably, they're never in a Beit Midrash, which is the locus of Talmud. They're never in the study hall. So I did a check. On no occasion in the Zohar is anyone ever in a study hall. Every teaching is either at midnight or on the road. That this is certain, you know, there's probably something to say about that. Probably people have said it, but I just wanted to make some of these super thematic elements explicit, as it might help us frame. So everything will either be, and of course the road takes on this kind of like exilic on the road, you know, on the road to what? On the road to the future. And the midnight study vigil is the future. It's the wedding represents the institution of the messianic era of God's loving relationship with us or whatever. So they're not unrelated. And even so, this teaching is going to be about a little bit about that. Okay. Now in the mat, for some reason, it doesn't break, at least in my Kindle version, the paragraphs in the right way. And maybe the print version is different, but we'll just get into the Aramaic. Amar le Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar says, but this is, they break it correctly in Svari, and in all the classic editions, this is a new paragraph here. So like what I mean, I guess, to say is, in my mat here, Rabbi Elazar said to him, occurs like randomly, but this should be a full paragraph break, new chapter. In most classic editions, this is a new chapter right here. And in this mat edition that I have in the Kindle, it just reads like a response to what's before it, which is, it's really not. It's a new feature.
It's at least a separate paragraph.
What?
In the print edition, it's a separate paragraph.
Ah, okay. I'm glad to know that in the print is a separate paragraph. Then I will just say that the Kindle edition has an issue. But that, you know, okay. It's interesting. Kindle print. Okay. Amar le Rabbi Elazar, hai ka dechziv, mi lo yiracha melech hagoyim, ki lecha yata. I want us to look at the whole verse. So this is the 10th chapter of Jeremiah, so you need to know what the beginning is. Shimu et, everyone see Sepharia here? I think the context will be important, especially because in the Zohar, they'll quote the first part of the verse, then the next part of the verse, sometimes the prior verse. It's good to just get it first. So not like, where's this verse? We just get it. Shimu et ha-davar asher diber ha-shem aleichem beit Yisrael. Jeremiah rebuking the people, hear the word which the Lord has spoken to you, O house of Israel. Ko amar Adonai derech ha-goyim al tilmadu umeoto tashmaim al techatu ki yechatu ha-goyim mehema. Do not learn to go the way of the nations, and do not be dismayed by portents in the sky. Oto tashmaim, the foreboding signs of the sky. But let the nations be dismayed by them. Ki chukota mim hevel hu. For the laws of the nations are hevel, vanity, here delusions. Ki eitz miyar krato maaseh yidei harash v'ma'atzad. For it is the work of the craftsmen's hands, the idols, that is, the laws of the nations are idol laws. He cuts down a tree in the forest with an axe to make it. You know, it's like you go and build those gods. The kesef uvizahav yiyapehu b'mas merot uvimakavot yechazkum v'lo yafik. He adorns it with silver and gold. He fastens it with nails and hammers so that it does not totter. You have to, you know, make it nice and sturdy. Tomer mikshahim avlo yedaberu naso kilo yitzadu al tifumehem kilo yareu v'gam hitivein otam. They're like a scarecrow in the cucumber patch. It feels like a good title for a book or something, like a scarecrow in a cucumber patch. They cannot speak. They have to be carried, echoing so many psalms, right? Like the ones in Hallel, you know, that the idols, they don't do much. They have to be carried, for they cannot walk. Be not afraid of them, for they can do no harm, nor is it in them to do any good. They do no good. Me'ain, okay, full stop. Me'ain kamocha Hashem gadol atav gadol shem chadigvura. So in that context, by foil, God, me'ain kamocha. There's no one like you. There's nothing like you. Gadol atav gadol shem chadigvura. Your name is great, and your name is great in big gvura, and power. Now gvura is an actual sphira, but okay. Now milo yiracham elecha goyim, who would not fear you, king of the nations? Ki lecha yata, for that is what is owed to you. That was what makes sense. You, God, are so powerful. Just it's plain. It makes sense to fear you. The name of this ma'amar, for amongst all the wise among the nations and all of their kings, so we have two kind of things here, their wisdom leaders who are going to be a philosopher in the Zohar is going to make an appearance. And it's always nice when a philosopher appears in the Zohar, that's like they bring things to a head. And amongst all, I know some of you are philosophers, are professors of philosophy. Me'en kamocha. Will Krieger always cautions me that there's a difference between philosophers and professors of philosophy. I don't know if that's true. And amongst all the kings, there are none like you. Okay. That's the full verse. So back to the Zohar. I just have to click. We got it? Okay. Ki lo yiracham melech ha-gayim ki v'chayata. Mai shvacha yihu. Amar leo lazer bri, hai krab b'kama duch deitmar. Ava vadai lav yihu dechtiv ki b'choach ne-goyim v'chom malchutam. Deha ata lemivtach puma dechayvin dechashvin dekutcha brichu v'yaday yurhurin amachshavin dilon. V'ginkach itlo da shtuta dilahon. So you get here a little thing. Rabbi Elazar said to him, to Rabbi Shimon, his father, one of the things I realized about Rabbi Shimon, I was reviewing during my leave, I reviewed what we learned the past semester. It's always good to go back and do Zohar. There's several times where Rabbi Shimon knows what happens, like their encounter with the donkey driver, an encounter with Rav Hamnu Nasava, other things. and then is able to tell them things about their own encounter, even though he wasn't there. So I was just struck by the kind of omnipotence or omnipresence of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, just in the stories where he knows what's going on, even when he's not present, which I think is when I was trying to figure out, like, why does he seem so mythical in the Zohar? And I'm like, wait, he knows everything that's happening, even when he's not there. That's not normal. And so there's a sort of, okay. Anyway, Rabbi Elazar said to him, to Rabbi Shimon, his father, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, the hero, this verse that is written, who would not be in awe of you, O King of the nations? Ki v'chayata, for it befits you. What kind of praise is that? Now, what's the question here? What kind of praise is that?
Like, how could you even compare Hashem to a human being?
Right, and it's really in part going on the first part, right, of the verse, which isn't really quoted here. Amongst all the Gentile kings and Gentile philosophers, there's no one like you. And there's always like, well, they're not so great. Like, that's not much of a praise. You know, you're better than Chinese political rulers. Okay. They're scoundrels. Like, you know, that's no praise. Maybe. He replied, it's more than that, but he replied, Elazar, my son, this verse has been discussed in various places. What are those various places? So Daniel Matt is so good in telling us. Shmot Rabbah, for example. So the Shmot Rabbah is the longest discussion of it. In case you wanted it, here it is. I just loaded it. Because they are referring to existing teachings. Nilo Yirech HaMelech HaGim Kilachayata. Amru Nabiim, I'm not going to read the whole thing, just give you a flavor for it. The prophet said to Jeremiah, Mari Delomar Melech HaGoyim. What did they see to say, the kings of the nations? Kol HaNaviim Koreinu to Melech Israel. Our God is the God of Israel, not the God of the nations. It says he's the God of the nations in this. So wait, is he the God of the nations, the God of Israel? V'ata Koreinu to Melech HaGoyim, but you, Jeremiah, are calling him king of the nations. He's our God, not their God. Amar lahen, shamati mimenu. You know, I heard, Navi l'goyim netaticha. I heard from him, from God, that I am giving a prophet to the nations. I'm giving you as a prophet to the nations. Ani amarti melech ha-goyim. Lamar ima banavi abanimit lochas alachirim huchas. Okay, if it goes on like this, kind of back and forth between Jeremiah and other prophets about, is it this God of the God of the Jews, or king of the Jews, or is he the king of the nations? Anyway, it goes on and on and on and on. It's a whole back and forth, but that's the flavor of that passage that they're referring to in the Zohar. Were you seeing the Zohar the whole time, or were you seeing this? Shmot Rabbah, what do you see?
Zohar.
Oh, I thought I loaded it. Okay.
We were anyway, listening.
Yeah, and anyway, there's a whole back and forth. Who is God really? Should he even be described as king of the Gentiles? That's the kind of midrash, and that's posited as a debate between Jeremiah and the other prophets in this kind of timeless prophet academy. So this verse has been discussed in various places. That's the main one, and a lot of traditions that appear in other places all appear in that one Shmot Rabbah. But it is certainly not so. For it is certain, since among all the wise of the nations and among all their kingdoms, there is none like you, providing a pretext for sinners who think that the Blessed Holy One does not know their thoughts and fantasies. So wait. They say that this verse, there is none like you among the nations, me'en kamocha, provides a pretext for sinners who think that God doesn't know what they are fantasizing about, and their fantasies are evil designs. How is that true? How does this verse give a pretext for a Gentile reading the Bible to assume that the meaning of this verse is that God doesn't know what they're thinking about? So it's actually not obvious how you interpret it in that way. Like the Zohar just kind of assumes it, but it's like it would be easy to skip it. But my inclination is when things aren't easy to explain, we probably shouldn't skip them. So Matt helps, apparently, because it's a little hard to understand, apparently, since the verse compares God with the wise of the nations, although contrasting the two, right? You are not like the wise of the nations. Sinners could conclude that just as those wise ones cannot conceive the thoughts of other humans, neither can God. Like, you're so much better than the wise among the nations. Well, if you're so much better, you're comparable, which brings two problems. One is, why are you comparing God to the wise among the nations? They're kind of not so, like, what kind of praise is that? The first question. And the second question is, if we're going to take this comparison seriously, does God have the limits? And in this case, why do they assume the limit of omniscience as the one, especially when Rabbi Shimon has this, I just noted, like, he knows everything somehow, always. but in any event, that's the sense of it, I think. That's the best I could come up with, too. I don't know if anyone else has a different, and a lot of the commentaries struggle with the plain meaning here. Like,
yeah, it doesn't, that interpretation just doesn't make any sense. I think it just doesn't work at all for the reason you mentioned, right? Because God is not like the wise people. So they're limited. He's not. So so I don't get it there.
The only thing I could, I came up with, but I couldn't find it written in any kind of plain language commentary. And I looked at even the Ramak or Nerav, I looked at the real classic commentaries, because you never want to say new things about the Zohar. Because you might wind up in hell, as per the earlier Zohar. With that caveat, it could be me'ein kamocha, there is none like you, is reinterpreted by a bad reader of Hebrew, and maybe the assumption is they actually don't know language so well, as me'ein kamocha, like me'ein from ayin, not at all, like you're not around. Who is like you among the nations? Yeah, or you're not like the people of the nations, me'ein kamocha. You're not even here. Like, in other words, you're so far removed from us that you actually don't know what we do. In other words, it almost borders on a theological claim, which is that shtei rishiyot, there are two forces here. There's good and evil. And if you're so good, well, we're evil. And so you don't know our fantasies because we're demonic and devilish and you're angelic and beneficent. That's the best I came up with before I read the Matt comment in my prep.
I have a theory, but it requires you just to scroll back up a paragraph because I have a question. Where'd that go? Wait, I just lost. Now I that scroll lost me. Where if you find Eliezer, okay. So look, that's it. The very bottom. Notice the phrase "there is none like you" is bracketed, right? Which I'm suggest. I gather that means, is that Matt adding it? It's not in the original text. He's like, this is an editorial reminder, completing the sentence.
That's right. Yeah.
All right. So I think that's misleading. Imagine that. And if we read the whole context, I hope I can hold on to it. I'm about to lose it, I think. If we read the whole context, Rabbi Eliezer has said, the verse is written, who would not be in awe of you, right? That's the starting point there. Who would not be in awe of you? And then the reply is to Eliezer. It says, it is certainly not so. So what is it that is not so? Presumably, Eleazar has suggested everyone is in awe of you. But now the response is saying, that's not so. There are some who are not in awe of you, right? That's what the it is not so seems to be suggesting. For it is written among the wise men. So if you leave out the bracketed part, then what I think is being said in the response is, the wise men are in awe of you. But not everyone is in awe of you. So therefore, the not wise people, the bad people, are not in awe of you. And then it's not so far to go from there. Well, why wouldn't they be in awe of you? Well, presumably they think you don't know their thoughts, right? It's like, so this phrase among the wise men is the contrast between those who are in awe and those who are not in awe. And once you separate those who are not in awe, it's not too far a leap to imagine why they're not in awe. Namely, because they think God doesn't know their thoughts. So it has nothing to do with the comparison between God and the wise people. it has to do with the fact that this question, who would not be in awe of you? That's what's really the
driving. And the answer is, well, there are a lot of people not in awe of you, God.
Right.
And this, right. And that actually, that's what's kind of nice is it's like a rubber hitting the road. It's like, there's this biblical, who would not be in awe of you? It's like, have you met humans? It's kind of this, right? Like, are you alive? Lots of, you know, certain people are in awe of you in this interpretation of the wise among the nations, but you know, how many wise people are there? You know, depending on how elitist you want to be. Yeah.
We've got the seven in this group. That's the start.
yeah, at least the six of you.
And for Christians, there's three plus a virgin.
Yeah, right.
So, however you understand this, the conclusion is, so their stuta, their stupidity, must be exposed. Right, those that are, you know, think that, whatever it is, some people think that God doesn't know their thoughts and fantasies. And this apparently is the seat or the located by the Zohar as the reason for yirah, for awe. And and that makes a certain amount of sense, just intuitively. Like, it also fits with a Zoharic theory of emanation. Right. In other words, the whole Zohar and this teaching is going to really get there in an extreme subversive way in a minute. The whole Zohar is about God emanating within and through and not being distinct. And so, you know, those that think that God doesn't know their thoughts, like they certainly don't think God is present in their actions. Right. Which is the Zoharic claim of divine presence and emanation. All right. So. Let me go back. I don't know if we read this in the Aramaic, but I cry, lo aski yekareko kach tefiki b'cholach meganim avachomach utamin kamocha. My shikula dalit ninasha delate lon kiyuma v'tu de'atun amrin v'lo kam navi od b'Yisrael kemoshe b'Yisrael lo kamaval b'umot ha'olam kam. Bilam, I'm adding that. Uf hachiana ema bechachme goim en kamohu, ava bechachme Yisrael it I hachi elaha it bechachme Yisrael kevatilav ihu la shalita istakel bekravitishtar to diakne kiddeka yut aminale medai shapir ka amart. Okay. Once a Gentile philosopher came to me and said, and here, you know, we get the classic Zohar encounter. So now we get Rabbi Shimon talking about an encounter with a Gentile philosopher. And in the commentaries, they ascribe various great ancient philosophers to this role. You know, there's a contest. Which great philosopher is this meeting Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai? Is this Plato? Is this Aristotle? Who is this great philosopher? He winds up converting in any event. We will get there. Once a Gentile philosopher came to me and said, you claim that your God rules all the heights of heaven and all the hosts and camps cannot grasp or know his sight. And again, the place that the camps cannot grasp or know is Bina, right? Or Keter in the Sefirot chart, right? Depending. But Bina is this kind of tower that it's the limit of human comprehension. So that's at least the first place we can't know. And Keter represents the full I am, the full nothingness of God's what we can know. Well, this verse does not exalt him very well, then, since among all the wise of the nations and among all their kingdoms, there is none like you. What kind of comparison is this to human beings who do not endure? So the Gentile philosopher comes and quotes this verse and says, there's none, you know, you claim that God is this unknowable majesty, but this verse says, here in your Bible, that there's none like him among all the Gentile nations. That's not a very big, you know, that doesn't match the grandeur of your mystical claims, Rabbi Shimon. In other words, that implies a God who's beyond, but not as beyond as you want him to be. Furthermore, you say, never again did there arise in Israel a prophet like Moses. And the Talmudic tradition quoted in Brachot and in the Midrashim is that Moses was the greatest prophet among Israel, but Bilam HaRasha was the greatest prophet among the, was a greater prophet than Moses, because he knew how to discern the moment of God's anger and channel that into curses. Maimonides doesn't agree with that. It's a separate issue. Maimonides thinks that Moses was the greatest prophet, not ever, but possible ever.
Which is probably a sub rosa attack on Islam, right? That Muhammad's claims are false, are necessarily false. That's how the Rambam talks about Islam, usually, about how ridiculous it is to think there could be another prophet, because except for Muhammad's prophecy, we agree with the rest of it.
I see. So, right. And the Rambam had other issues, right, as was noted in that somewhat controversial biography done by, who's the historian at JTS that wrote the compelling if controversial biography of Maimonides? Anyone know what I'm talking about?
Halbertal?
No.
Goodman, but he's not at JTS, right?
No. Okay. So there was a recent, very recent biography of Maimonides, which really delved into the rumors of his conversion to Islam in Egypt. In Egypt? Is that possible?
No, probably in Spain.
Spain.
Yeah.
In any event, they asserted new evidence in this biography. You should read it. It's good. That he really did convert to Islam. And not only did he convert to Islam, he was like the muezzin at the local mosque. At least that's the claim. And he became like an imam. And that a lot of his polemics against Islam can only be seen in light of the maybe forced conversion, which he likely underwent. That's one of the theories in this biography for a time. Then they claim, which is really interesting, that the people that forced his conversion, he had taken out and drowned in secret hits. Like he was really angry about it and had some people executed over it, using his newfound power within the Muslim. You have to read the biography. It makes it seem so much more interesting.
Is that based on anything other than his letter to the Jews of Yemen, where he says, "If I had to, I would do it." Right.
Yeah, yeah. So in the letter to the Jews of Yemen, he says, they asked him, should we convert if we're forced to convert? And he says, you should. And if I had to, I would. But they actually try and bring local evidence from, I don't remember the details, the governing Islamic authorities then, that there was this new imam in town who was super sharp and a philosopher that like converted and was in good. They bring outside Jewish evidence that they think that they note some of the counter evidence. But anyway, check out that biography, which has no name or author that I know of. All I know is after I read it, I never looked at the Rambam the same, even if it's not true. It would make a great story. Some kind of historian at GTS, I think. Okay, so in any event, the rabbinic tradition is not like this idea. The rabbinic tradition is that Bilam is a greater prophet. So the philosopher also raises this. Of course, the Gentile philosopher would raise this claim. You say that there was never a prophet like Moshe in Israel. In Israel, none arose, but among the nations of the world, one did. So it's parallel logic. God is greater than all of the Gentile philosophers, greater than the Gentile philosophers. But similarly, I can say, among all of the wise of the nations, there is none like him, but among the wise of the Israel, there is. Right? So this praise says there's no one like God among the wise of the nations. But maybe amongst you folk, there are divine incarnates running around, little Jesuses or whatever you want to say. And it's, and that's ridiculous, assumes the Gentile philosopher. So what kind of Bible is this? It's not precise. If so, a God who has an equal among the wise of Israel is not a God who reigns supreme. That's no God. Look closely at the verse and you will find I have been fittingly precise. I know, says the Gentile philosopher. This is the climax. Okay, right here. So, Amina le vadai shapir ka amar. So, Rabbi Shimon says to him, and we'll get to it in the mat in a minute, but then we'll read the rest of this. You're right. Not that we expect a denial or reinterpretation, but classically, the Gentile philosopher surprisingly exposes a deep mystical secret, just like the donkey drivers and the incarnations. And you're right, there are divine beings amongst the Jews. Okay, and here's where it gets interesting. Then this is where the Zohar differs from every other Jewish text. This is like one of these passages that's, and the Hasidim, I will say, we'll get to this, Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, Elimelech of Lishan, loved the Zohar. The Zohar is quoted a ton in the Hasidic talks. Whatever the famous thing he said is, Yareach Amad Kutcha Brichu goes there, Kazardin, Uvhahi Moshe Kazar Kazardin, and this time the two, the Kutcha Brichu goes there, Gizrin, the Tzadikai, Jisrael Mevat, in the Tachiv, Tzadik Moshe Yirat Elohim. Let's pause there. I replied, "You have certainly spoken well. Who revives the dead? The Blessed Holy One alone." Note the contrast, alone, the Chudai. "Along came Elijah and Elisha, and they revived the dead. Who makes the rain fall? The Blessed Holy One. Along came Elijah and withheld it, and that brought it down through his prayer," right? When he confronted the idol worshippers. "Who created heaven and earth on Har Carmel? Who created heaven and earth? The Blessed Holy One alone." Right, which was the passage we ended on last semester, which was when God speaks to the divine entourage in the royal we, or here the divine we, let's rename it. And there's a whole back and forth about precisely what place the angels have and the evil angels. And like, just when we say that God created, we want to be kind of clear that only God created, and exactly the nuance of that in an emanation theory. So who created heaven and earth? The Blessed Holy One alone. Abraham came and they were firmly established because of him. This quotes a teaching we heard earlier. Eile toldot ha-shamayim va'aretz v'hibra'am. It says at the end of the first creation story in Genesis 2. So the our chapter person, who is the chapter person? Pablo, no. Who is the person that made the chapters of the Bible? You want to remember? They weren't Jewish. So in any event, this is in chapter 2, I believe, of our Bible. This is where the chapter, so people commonly assume it's the introduction to the second creation story of Adam and Eve and the snake in the garden. But really, Eile toldot ha-shamayim va'aretz v'hi bara'am, these are the generations of the creation of the heavens and the earth in their creation, is the coda to Breshit or Elohim et ha-shamayim v'et ha-aretz. In the beginning, God's creation of the heaven and earth, blah, blah, blah. Eile toldot ha-shamayim va'aretz v'hi bara'am. These are the stories of what happened in there. It's the end of the introduction to Law and Order. These are their stories, right? So it's really the end or the capsule to the introduction. I confess my Law and Order addiction. Okay, so the Zohar, you may remember, reinterpreted B'hi Bara'am in their creation. B'Avraham rearranged the letters of B'hi Bara'am, and the world was created in Avraham. Before Avraham, there was no world. Olam Chesed Yibanan. Avraham represents loving kindness, and it talks about the world as a burst of loving kindness from Abraham, or created for the sake of Abraham and the Jewish people, right? So there's a lot in there, but it reinterprets B'hi Bara'am as B'Avraham. So here they quote that teaching that they've already taught us to say Abraham created the heavens and the earth, not God. It's kind of funny to have Abraham doing it, because Abraham, of course, is the one who takes the idols in his father's house and smashes them and is the anti-idol. But here, Abraham, the anti-idol, suddenly becomes the idol in the Zohar, which is always interesting. And the Zohar knows it's messing with us a little bit. Who controls the sun? The Blessed Holy One, right? Joshua came. And we just said that in the Hashemayim Misapri Kavod El. And they're referencing that, I believe. You know, we talked about the sun and the path of the sun in the heavens as divine. But the Blessed Holy One, Joshua, came and calmed it down during in Givon, in his war against the they needed more daylight, and he made the sun stand still, supposedly. Right. That's not really what it means. I think the Ralbag's interpretation on the spot is correct. It's a metaphor for how a victory that seemed unlikely occurred. It's as if God gave more daylight for the Jews to win. It's a metaphor. It's a literary metaphor, not an actual recounting of a miracle. That's, I think, the right way to understand the Bible. That's what Gersonides, ever the rationalist, says. But the Zohar, for sure, seems no, the miracle approach, right? And Joshua controls the sun, commanding it to stand in place. And by the way, Moshe sometimes represents the sun and Joshua the moon in the Zohar, which is interesting because Moshe is like the teacher and Joshua is the student. And so here it's interesting because when Joshua commands the sun to stand still, the Zohar may be intuiting another layer, which is Joshua commands the sun to stand still is itself a metaphor within a metaphor for how here at Tzaddikim, righteous people command God, right? Or up themselves a level in order to exert control, even though they are from within the creation. So Joshua, the moon, Shekhinah, is able to control sun, Kadosh Baruch Hu, through his righteousness, just as we, implication, just as we, through our righteousness, control that which is way above our pay grade. Someone's going to say something.
Really, this whole paragraph is that, how the righteous, quote unquote, control God, right? Or they direct or channel God's various energies.
Yeah, so, and they're going to make it about control. Right. So right, I think the Joshua Moses thing is the kind of conclusion to it all, because it's not just another example. Joshua and Moses are mystical symbols for the very premise being stated here. And so they conclude it with that, the actual biblical example of the symbol that is the premise, to give it the Zohar's classic literary layering, right? Which is, I think, what makes these texts so, it's because they kind of unfold. The Blessed Holy One issues decrees, and this is what the part that the Hasidic Zohar is quoting. God makes gezerot, right? Similarly, Moses issues decrees which were fulfilled. I don't know which decrees Moses issued which were fulfilled, by the way. Anyone knows what it's talking about? I was hoping for a footnote, but alas, there was none. Moses issued decrees which were fulfilled. I assume maybe it means by the rock, which is God told him to get water one way and he chose another way, right? He hid it rather than speaking to it. And even though that was wrong and he was punished for it, but the water still came out. I don't know if that's what it's talking about. That was my best guess. Anyone else has a better guess or another guess? Do say so. Further, the Blessed Holy One issues decrees, and the righteous of Israel abolish them. And you see why Hasidic Rebbes would quote this. I mean, there's a cynical interpretation, right? Which is, if you have the power to, you know, veto God's edicts, it's a lot of power. And then they quote, the righteous one rules the awe of God. So it's not a language of nuance where the righteous, you know, are able to channel through mystical action. The righteous one rules, Moshe, right? Which is like dominates, has a sense of the awe of God. It's a very strong language. The actual verse in Samuel, if you're curious of that context of that, does it say that? Not exactly, of course.
On the Moses decrees, I heard a drash the other day on this week's Parsha, which is because it's, I guess, unusual in the Atah Titzaveh, where it's like it's saying, so it's like Hashem saying, like, Moses, you make this order, not like Vaydeber Vayomer Hashem. Like, it has a different construction, and it's kind of like the Atah Titzaveh is like, you're going to make this decree about the So I don't know if that's helps at all, but it just kind of called to mind this drash I heard about that.
So this is David, Devrei David Achronim, the last words of David. So that this is actually part of David's farewell address. And of course, David's farewell address takes on significance because King David represents the Messianic era and the Shechina. So this is not just a statement about, and this is how we transition to the wedding, which is a Messianic event, by quoting David. Amar Elohei Yisrael, Li Diber Tzor Yisrael, Moshel Ba'adam Tzadik Moshel Yirat Elohim. So the God of Israel has spoken, the Rock of Israel, Tzor Yisrael, said concerning me, he who rules men justly, Moshel Ba'adam Tzadik, he who rules men or people justly, Moshel Yirat Elohim, he who rules in awe of God. So it's really just a classic biblical parallelism for one thing, Moshel Ba'adam Tzadik, you rule justly. What does it mean to rule justly? Moshel Yirat Elohim, to rule with fear of God. It's classic biblical parallelism where the second clause restates but deepens the sense of the first clause. But the Zohar reinterprets it. What does it mean to rule justly? To rule God, not to rule in awe of God, but to rule awe of God, to rule over awe of God. So the Zohar misquotes it, but the misquote is even better, kind of, than, okay.
I don't know the Hebrew grammar well enough to appreciate it, right? There's no direct object here, so it's not ruling the awe of God, right? That seems...
It doesn't say Moshel et Yirat Elohim, right?
Right, but nevertheless, even if the righteous one rules through the awe of God, the right, but either because he is in awe of God and that leads him to rule, or he rules others by invoking the fear of God, either way, the righteous person is controlling the flow of that fear of God, right? So there's a sense in which it still would be the case, even without the grammar there, that he's ruling the awe of God because he's the one who's controlling how that manifests itself.
Yeah, there is certainly a kind of Jewish version of a divine right of kings theology of sorts at play here. And the Zohar just kind of takes that to its most extreme manifestation, right, by playing with the language. But it's true, even in the verse, ruling in awe of God implies that this righteous person can do that. And so we'll conclude by further, he commanded them to walk in his ways. You know, so halachta bidrachav, which the Talmud, of course, says is God is merciful, you should be merciful, etc. He's kind, he visits the sick, God does these lovely things, you should do all the nice things. Here it's literally imitating him consummately. And let's go back to the Aramaic on that, and then we'll conclude today's session. So the actual thing is, to be comparative, le bekola, totally, to imitate God entirely. So this is a really important passage about the power of tzaddik, which is yesod, which controls the flow of divine blessing into the world. And since the righteous person becomes the path for flow into the world, and therefore of repair of the world, and therefore of messianic redemption, they are able to stop the flow at that juncture of negativity or of evil or demons, which we're going to get to. And they're able to channel, create, or cause new worlds and new flow through Chidushei Torah of divine light. And so here we get the beginning of the mystical instruction for how to be a Hasidic Rebbe, or how to be a Baal Shem, or like to change the physical reality that is present. And interestingly, this is done through benevolence, through limiting evil and limiting God's evil decrees, even if God chooses them, and through trying to generate goodness. So here we are with this passage of the Zohar, but we'll conclude by saying the Gentiles philosopher says, isn't it true, according to this Bible, if you read it with the kind of precision that you all read Talmudic texts and whatnot, you could say that, you're like God, and that's not very big praise of God. And the answer is, you could say that. You should say that. We are like God. We're better than God. We do it for real. We can...
I mean, that's a, and you said this is only in the Zohar, this kind of giving godly powers to humans among Israel is a wild statement.
Yeah, and what's even more wild is that the Zohar chooses a passage about the evils of idolatry to interpret as bestowing godly powers upon Israel. They take a passage about how idols are bad and humans aren't idols to say, we are God. And the Zohar is at its best when it's interpreting precisely the opposite of what the passage says in this way. So this is, I think this is just one of the most fun passages in the Zohar. There's just so much here. Anyway, so I hope this is a good passage to kick it back off and you remember why we do this on Wednesdays now. And next week, we will then begin to relate what does this have to do with the demons we met? You remember we met these demons, Arira and Azza and Azzael, and there are going to be four demons and one wedding and some wedding presents. We're going to weave the whole story into a kind of a finale of this ballet that is, okay, great. Thank you all. It's been good to be back.
To have you back.
Well, thank you.
Thank you.